Fabius Hobbes, Kant, and other modern thinkers. War was intellectualized as a game theoretic problem, to be solved by proactive institutional arrangements. Centuries later, some of these arrangements, such as Kant's triad of democratization, trade, and an international community, helped to drive down the rate of war in the long peace and the new peace. And the Cuban Missile Crisis was diffused when Kennedy and Khrushchev consciously reframed it as a trap for the two of them to escape without either side losing face. None of these rationales for rationality speaks to Hume's point that rationality is merely a means to an end, and that the end depends on the thinker's passions. Reason can lay out a roadmap to peace and harmony, if the reasoner wants peace and harmony, but it can also lay out a roadmap to war and strife, if the reasoner delights in war and strife. Do we have any reason to expect that rationality should orient a reasoner to wanting less violence? On the grounds of austere logic, the answer is no, but it doesn't take much to switch it to yes. All you need are two conditions. The first is that the reasoners care about their own well-being, that they prefer to live rather than die, keep their body parts intact rather than have them maimed, and spend their days in comfort rather than in pain. Mere logic does not force them to have those prejudices. Yet any product of natural selection, indeed, any agent that manages to endure the ravages of entropy long enough to be reasoning in the first place, will in all likelihood have them. The second condition is that the reasoners be part of a community of other agents who can impinge on their well-being and who can exchange messages and comprehend each other's reasoning. That assumption, too, is not logically necessary. One could imagine a Robinson Crusoe who reasons in solitude, or a galactic overlord who is untouchable by his subjects. But natural selection could not have manufactured a solitary reasoner because evolution works on populations, and Homo sapiens, in particular, is not just a rational animal, but a social and language-using one. As for the overlord, uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. Even he, in principle, must worry about the possibility of a fall from power that would require him to deal with his erstwhile underlings. As we saw at the end of Chapter 4, the assumptions of self-interest and sociality combine with reason to lay out a morality in which nonviolence is a goal. Violence is a prisoner's dilemma, in which either side can profit by preying on the other, but both are better off if neither one tries, since mutual predation leaves each side bruised and bloodied, if not dead. In the game theorist's definition of the dilemma, the two sides are not allowed to talk, and even if they were, they would have no grounds for trusting each other. But in real life, people can confer, and they can bind their promises with emotional, social, or legal guarantors. And as soon as one side tries to prevail on the other not to injure him, he has no choice but to commit himself not to injure the other side either. As soon as he says, "It's bad for you to hurt me," he's committed to, "It's bad for me to hurt you," since logic cannot tell the difference between me and you. After all, their meaning switches with every turn in the conversation. As the philosopher William Godwin put it, "What magic is there in the pronoun my that should justify us in overturning the decisions of impartial truth?" Nor can reason distinguish between Mike and Dave or Lisa and Amy or any other set of individuals, because as far as logic is concerned, they're just a bunch of X's and Y's. So, as soon as you try to persuade someone to avoid harming you by appealing to reasons why he shouldn't, you're sucked into a commitment to the avoidance of harm as a general goal. And to the extent that you pride yourself on the quality of your reason, work to apply it far and wide, and use it to persuade others, you will be forced to deploy that reason in pursuit of universal interests, including an avoidance of violence. Humans, of course, were not created in a state of original reason. We descended from apes, spent hundreds of millennia in small bands, and evolved our cognitive processes in the service of hunting, gathering, and socializing. Only gradually, with the appearance of literacy, cities, and long-distance travel and communication, could our ancestors cultivate the faculty of reason and apply it to a broader range of concerns, a process that is still ongoing. One would expect that as collective rationality is honed over the ages, it will progressively whittle away at the short-sighted and hot-blooded impulses toward violence and force us to treat a greater number of rational agents as we would have them treat us. Our cognitive faculties need not have evolved to go in this direction. But once you have an open-ended reasoning system, even if it evolved from mundane problems like preparing food and securing alliances, you can't keep it from entertaining propositions that are consequences of other propositions. When you acquired your mother tongue and came to understand, this is the cat that killed the rat, nothing could prevent you from understanding, this is the rat that ate the malt. When you learned how to add 37 plus 24, nothing could prevent you from deriving the sum of 32 plus 47. Cognitive scientists call this feat systematicity and attribute it to the combinatorial power of the neural systems that underlie language and reasoning. So if the members of species have the power to reason with one another and enough opportunities to exercise that power, sooner or later they will stumble upon the mutual benefits of nonviolence and other forms of reciprocal consideration and apply them more and more broadly. This is the theory of the expanding circle, as Peter Singer originally formulated it. Though I have co-opted his metaphor as a name for the historical process in which increased opportunities for perspective-taking led to sympathy for more diverse groups of people, Singer himself did not have the emotions in mind so much as the intellect. He is a philosopher's philosopher, and argued that over the eons, people had the power to literally think their way into greater respect for the interests of others. And that respect cannot be confined to the interests of the people with whom we rub shoulders in a small social circle. Just as you can't favor yourself over someone else when holding up ideals on how to behave, you can't favor members of your group over the members of another group. For Singer, it is hard-headed reason more than soft-hearted empathy that expands the ethical circle ever outward. Beginning to reason is like stepping onto an escalator that leads upward and out of sight. Once we take the first step, the distance to be traveled is independent of our will, and we cannot know in advance where we shall end. If we do not understand what an escalator is, we might get on it intending to go a few meters, only to find that once we are on, it is difficult to avoid going all the way to the end. Similarly, once reasoning has got started, it is hard to tell where it will stop. The idea of disinterested defense of one's conduct emerges because of the social nature of human beings and the requirements of group living, but in the thought of reasoning beings, it takes on a logic of its own, which leads to its extension beyond the bounds of the group. In the historical sequence that Singer adduces, the moral circle of the early Greeks was confined to the city-state, as in this unintentionally comical epitaph from the mid-5th century CE. This memorial is set over the body of a very good man, Pythian, from Megara, slew 7 men and broke off 7 spear points in their bodies. This man, who saved 3 Athenian regiments, having brought sorrow to no one among all men who dwell on earth, went down to the underworld, felicitated in the eyes of all. Plato widened the circle a bit by arguing that Greeks should spare other Greeks from devastation and enslavement, visiting these fates only on non-Greeks. In modern times, Europeans expanded the no-taking slaves rule to other Europeans, but Africans were fair game. Today, of course, slavery is illegal for everyone. The only problem with Singer's metaphor is that the history of moral concern looks less like an escalator than an elevator that gets stuck on a floor for a seeming eternity, then lurches up to the next floor, gets stuck there for a while, and so on. Singer's history finds just 4 circle sizes in almost 2.5 millennia, which works out to 1 ascent every 625 years. That feels a bit jerky for an escalator. Singer acknowledges the bumpiness of moral progress and attributes it to the rarity of great thinkers. Insofar as the timing and success of the emergence of a questioning spirit is concerned, history is a chronicle of accidents. Nevertheless, if reasoning flourishes within the confines of customary morality, progress in the long run is not accidental. From time to time, outstanding thinkers will emerge who are troubled by the boundaries that custom places on their reasoning, for it is in the nature of reasoning that it dislikes notices saying off-limits. Reasoning is inherently expansionist. It seeks universal application. Unless crushed by countervailing forces, each new application will become part of the territory of reasoning bequeathed to future generations. But it remains puzzling that these outstanding thinkers have appeared so rarely on the world's stage, and that the expansion of reason should have dawdled so. Why did human rationality need thousands of years to arrive at the conclusion that something might be a wee bit wrong with slavery, or with beating children, raping unattached women, exterminating native peoples, imprisoning homosexuals, or waging wars to assuage the injured vanity of kings? It shouldn't take an Einstein to figure it out. One possibility is that the theory of an escalator of reason is historically incorrect, and that humanity was led up the incline of moral progress by the heart rather than the head. A different possibility is that Singer is right, at least in part, but the escalator is powered not just by the sporadic appearance of outstanding thinkers, but by a rise in the quality of everyone's thinking. Perhaps we're getting better because we're getting smarter. Believe it or not, we are getting smarter. In the early 1980s, the philosopher James Flynn had a eureka moment when he noticed that the companies that sell IQ tests periodically renorm the scores. The average IQ has to be 100 by definition. But the percentage of questions answered correctly is an arbitrary number that depends on how hard the questions are. The testmongers have to map the percentage correct scale onto the IQ scale by a formula, but the formula keeps getting out of whack. The average scores on the tests had been creeping up for decades, so to keep the average at 100, every once in a while they jiggered the formula so the test takers would need a larger number of correct answers to earn a given IQ. Otherwise, there would be IQ inflation. This inflation, Flynn realized, is not a kind that one should try to whip, but is telling us something important about recent history and the human mind. Later generations, given the same set of questions as earlier ones, got more of them correct. Later generations must be getting better at whatever skills IQ tests measure. Since IQ tests have been administered in massive numbers all over the world for much of the 20th century, in some countries, down to the last school child and draftee, one can plot a country's change in measured intelligence over time. Flynn scoured the world for data sets in which the same IQ test was given over many years, where the scoring norms were available to keep the numbers commensurate. The result was the same in every sample. IQ scores increased over time. In 1994, Richard Herrnstein and the political scientist Charles Murray christened the phenomenon the Flynn effect, and the name has stuck. The Flynn effect has been found in 30 countries, including some in the developing world, and it has been going on ever since IQ tests were first given en masse around the time of World War I. An even older data set from Britain suggests that the Flynn effect may even have begun with the cohort of Britons who were born in 1877, though, of course, they were tested as adults. The gains are not small. An average of 3 IQ points, a fifth of a standard deviation per decade. The implications are stunning. An average teenager today, if he or she could time travel back to 1950, would have had an IQ of 118. If the teenager went back to 1910, he or she would have had an IQ of 130, besting 98% of his or her contemporaries. Yes, that's right. If we take the Flynn effect at face value, a typical person today is smarter than 98% of the people in the good old days of 1910. To state it in an even more jarring way, a typical person of 1910, if time transported forward to the present, would have a mean IQ of 70, which is at the border of mental retardation. With the Raven's progressive matrices, a test that is sometimes considered the purest measure of general intelligence, the rise is even steeper. An ordinary person of 1910 would have an IQ of 50 today, which is smack in the middle of mentally retarded territory between moderate and mild retardation. Obviously, we can't take the Flynn effect at face value. The world of 1910 was not populated by people who today we would consider mentally retarded. Commentators have looked for ways to make the Flynn effect go away, but none of the obvious ones work. Writers on the egalitarian left and on the lift-yourself-up-by-the-bootstraps right have long tried to undermine the very idea of intelligence and the instruments that claim to measure it. But the scientists who study human individual differences are virtually unanimous that intelligence can be measured, that it is fairly stable over a lifetime of an individual, and that it predicts academic and professional success at every level of the scale. Perhaps you might think, children got more quiz savvy over the decades as schools began to test the living daylights out of them. But as Flynn points out, the gains have been steady over time, while the popularity of testing has waxed and waned. Could it be, then, that the content of the test questions like, "Who wrote Romeo and Juliet?" have become common knowledge, or that the words in the vocabulary section have spread into everyday parlance, or that the arithmetic problems have been taught earlier in school? Unfortunately, the biggest gains in the IQ tests are found in exactly those items that do not tap knowledge, vocabulary, or arithmetic. They are found in the items that tap abstract reasoning, such as similarities. What do a pound and an inch have in common? Analogies. Bird is to egg as tree is to what? And visual matrices, where geometric patterns fill the rows and columns of a grid, and the test taker has to figure out how to fill a gap at the bottom right. For example, going from left to right in each row, a shape may acquire a border, lose a vertical line, and then have a hollow area blacked in. The subtests on vocabulary and math have shown the smallest rise over time, and other tests that are filled with them, like the SAT, have even shown a bit of a decline in some age groups in some years. The Flynn effect was a scientific bombshell because if one were to focus only on the improvement in the matrices and similarities, one would think that what rose over the decades was general intelligence. These subtests are considered the purest measures of general intelligence because they correlate well with the tendency of people to score well or poorly on a large battery of dissimilar tests. That tendency is called G, and the existence of G is often considered the most important discovery in the science of mental testing. If you give people just about any test you can think of that taps the common sense notion of intelligence, math, vocabulary, geometry, logic, test comprehension, factual knowledge, the people who do well on one also tend to do well on the others. That was not a foregone conclusion. We all know the inarticulate math whiz and the eloquent poet who can't balance a checkbook, and one might have thought that the different kinds of intelligence trade off resources in the brain, so that the more neural tissue you have for math, the less you have for language and vice versa. Not so. Some people are indeed relatively better at math than others, and some relatively better at language, but compared to the population as a whole, the two talents, and every other talent that we associate with the concept of intelligence, tend to go together. General intelligence, moreover, is highly heritable and mostly unaffected by the family environment, though it may be affected by the cultural environment. We know this because measures of G in adults are strongly correlated in identical twins separated at birth and are not at all correlated in adopted siblings who have been raised in the same family. General intelligence is also correlated with several measures of neural structure and functioning, including the speed of information processing, the overall size of the brain, the thickness of the gray matter in the cerebral cortex, and the integrity of the white matter connecting one cortical region to another. Most likely, G represents the summed effects of many genes, each of which affects brain functioning in a small way. The bombshell is that the Flynn effect is almost certainly environmental. Natural selection has a speed limit measured in generations, but the Flynn effect is measurable on the scale of decades and years. Flynn was also able to rule out increases in nutrition, overall health, and outbreeding, marrying outside one's local community as explanations for his eponymous effect. Whatever propels the Flynn effect, then, is likely to be in people's cognitive environments, not in their genes, diets, vaccines, or dating pools. A breakthrough in the mystery of the Flynn effect was the realization that the increases are not gains in general intelligence. If they were, they would have lifted the scores on all the subtests, including vocabulary, math, and raw memory power, with a rate related to the degree each test correlates with G. In fact, the boost was concentrated in subtests like similarities and matrices. Whatever the mystery factor in the environment may be, it is highly selective in the components of intelligence it is enhancing, not raw brain power, but the abilities needed to score well on the subtests of abstract reasoning. The best guess is that the Flynn effect has several causes, which may have acted with different strengths at different times in the century. The improvements on visual matrices may have been fueled by an increasingly high-tech and symbol-rich environment that forced people to analyze visual patterns and connect them to arbitrary rules. But proficiency with visuals is a sideshow to understanding the gains in intelligence that might be relevant to moral reasoning. Flynn identifies the newly rising ability as post-scientific, as opposed to pre-scientific thinking. Consider a typical question from the similarities section of an IQ test. What do dogs and rabbits have in common? The answer, obvious to us, is that they are both mammals. But an American in 1900 would have been just as likely to say, "You use dogs to hunt rabbits." The difference, Flynn notes, is that today we spontaneously classify the world with the categories of science, but not so long ago the correct answer would seem abstruse and irrelevant. Who cares that they are both mammals? Flynn imagines a test taker asking in 1900, "That is the least important thing about them from his point of view. What is important is orientation in space and time, what things are useful, and what things are under one's control." Flynn was putting words in the mouths of the dead, but that style of reasoning has been documented in studies of pre-modern peoples by psychologists such as Michael Cole and Alexander Luria. Luria transcribed interviews with Russian peasants in remote parts of the Soviet Union who were given similarities questions like the ones on IQ tests. Question: what do a fish and a crow have in common? Answer: a fish. It lives in the water. A crow flies. If the fish just lies on top of the water, the crow would peck at it. A crow can eat a fish, but a fish can't eat a crow. Question: could you use one word for them both, such as animals? Answer: if you call them animals, that wouldn't be right. A fish isn't an animal, and a crow isn't either. A person can eat a fish, but not a crow. Luria's informants also rejected a purely hypothetical mode of thinking, the stage of cognition that Jean Piaget calls formal, as opposed to concrete, operations. Question: all bears are white where there is always snow. In Novaya Zemlya, there is always snow. What color are the bears there? Answer: I have seen only black bears, and I do not talk of what I have not seen. Question: but what do my words imply? Answer: if a person has not been there, he cannot say anything on the basis of words. If a man was 60 or 80 and had seen a white bear there and told me about it, he could be believed. Flynn remarks, the peasants are entirely correct. They understand the difference between analytic and synthetic propositions. Pure logic cannot tell us anything about facts, only experience can. But this will do them no good on current IQ tests. That is because current IQ tests tap abstract formal reasoning, the ability to detach oneself from parochial knowledge of one's own little world and explore the implications of postulates in purely hypothetical worlds. If Flynn is right that much of the Flynn effect is caused by an increasing tendency to see the world through scientific spectacles, as he puts it, what are the exogenous causes of the availability of those spectacles? An obvious one is schooling. We know that schooling coaxes adolescents from Piaget's stage of concrete operation to his stage of formal operations, and that even with schooling, not everyone makes the transition. Over the course of the 20th century, and all over the world, children came to spend more time in school. In 1900, an average American adult had 7 years of schooling, and a quarter of them had less than 4 years. Only in the 1930s did high school become compulsory. And during this transition, the nature of the schooling changed. Early in the century, reading consisted of standing and reciting aloud from books. As the education researcher Richard Rothstein observed, many World War I recruits failed a basic written intelligence test partly because, even if they had attended a few years of school and learned how to read aloud, they were being asked by the Army to understand and interpret what they had read, a skill that many of them had never learned. Another researcher, Jeremy Genovese, documented the changing goals of education in the 20th century by analyzing the content of the high school entrance exams in 1902 through 13, and comparing them to high school proficiency tests given to students of the same age in the 1990s. As far as factual knowledge is concerned, less is expected of adolescents today. For example, in the geography section of today's high-stakes test, the students were asked to pick out the United States on a map of the world. Their great-grandparents were required to name the states you would pass through in traveling on a meridian from Columbus, Ohio, to the Gulf of Mexico, and name and locate the capital of each. On the other hand, a typical test item today requires students to grapple with rates, amounts, multiple contingencies, and basic economics. A community is located in a region where very little drinking water is available. In order to manage their water resources, which of the following should the community not do? A. Increase their water usage. B. Buy water from another community. C. Install water-saving devices in homes. D. Charge higher rates for water. Anyone who understands the phrase law of supply and demand realizes that option D cannot be the correct answer. But if you simply have an image of a pool of water and people drinking from it, the connection between how much it costs and how quickly it shrinks is not immediately apparent. Flynn suggests that over the course of the 20th century, scientific reasoning infiltrated from the schoolhouse and other institutions into everyday thinking. More people worked in offices and the professions where they manipulated symbols rather than crops, animals, and machines. People had more time for leisure, and they spent it in reading, playing combinatorial games, and keeping up with the world. And, Flynn suggests, the mindset of science trickled down to everyday discourse in the form of shorthand abstractions. A shorthand abstraction is a hard-won tool of technical analysis that, once grasped, allows people to effortlessly manipulate abstract relationships. Anyone capable of reading this book, even without training in science or philosophy, has probably assimilated hundreds of these abstractions from casual reading, conversation, and exposure to the media, including proportional, percentage, correlation, causation, control group, placebo, representative sample, false positive, empirical, post hoc, statistical, median, variability, circular argument, trade-off, and cost-benefit analysis. Yet each of them, even a concept as second nature to us as percentage, at one time trickled down from the academy and other highbrow sources and increased in popularity in printed usage over the course of the 20th century. It isn't just the chattering classes that have absorbed the shorthand abstractions of the technocracy. The linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has commented on Bruce Springsteen's lyric in The River, "I got a job working construction for the Johnstown Company, but lately there ain't been much work on account of the economy." Only in the last 40 years, Nunberg notes, would ordinary people have talked about the economy as a natural force with causal powers like the weather. Earlier, they might have said, on account of times are hard. Or he might have added, on account of the Jews, the Negroes, or the rich peasants. We can now put together the two big ideas of this section, the pacifying effects of reason and the Flynn effect. We have several grounds for supposing that enhanced powers of reason, specifically the ability to set aside immediate experience, detach oneself from a parochial vantage point, and frame one's ideas in abstract, universal terms, would lead to better moral commitments, including an avoidance of violence. And we have just seen that over the course of the 20th century, people's reasoning abilities, particularly their ability to set aside immediate experience, detach themselves from a parochial vantage point, and think in abstract terms, were steadily enhanced. Can we put these two ideas together to help explain the documented declines of violence in the second half of the 20th century, the Long Peace, New Peace, and rights revolutions? Could there be a moral Flynn effect, in which an accelerating escalator of reason carried us away from impulses that lead to violence? The idea is not crazy. The cognitive skill that is most enhanced in the Flynn effect, abstraction from the concrete particulars of immediate experience, is precisely the skill that must be exercised to take the perspectives of others and expand the circle of moral consideration. Flynn himself drew the connection in recounting a conversation he had with his Irish father, who was born in 1884 and was highly intelligent, but relatively unschooled. "My father had so much hatred for the English that there was little room left over for prejudice against any other group, but he harbored a bit of racism against blacks, and my brother and I tried to talk him out of it. What if you woke up one morning and discovered your skin had turned black? Would that make you any less of a human being?" He shot back, "Now that's the stupidest thing you've ever said. Who ever heard of a man's skin turning black overnight?" Like the Russian peasant considering the color of bears, Flynn's father was stuck in a concrete, pre-scientific mode of thinking. He refused to enter a hypothetical world and explore its consequences, which is one of the ways people can rethink their moral commitments, including their tribalism and racism. Or consider the high school test question about the water usage in a particular town, which requires, among other things, thinking about proportions. Flynn notes that proportionality questions are surprisingly difficult for many adolescents and are among the skills that rose as part of the Flynn effect. As we have seen, the mindset of proportionality is essential to calibrating the just use of violence, as in criminal punishment and military action. One has only to replace "manage their water resources" with "manage their crime rate" in the test question to see how an increase in intelligence should translate into more humane policies. A recent test by the psychologist Michael Sargent showed that people with a high need for cognition, the trait of enjoying mental challenges, have less punitive attitudes toward criminal justice even after taking into account their age, sex, race, education, income, and political orientation. Before we test the idea that the Flynn effect accelerated an escalator of reason and led to greater moral breadth and less violence, we need a sanity check on the Flynn effect itself. Could the people of today really be that much smarter than the people of yesterday? Flynn himself, in an early paper, noted incredulously that in some countries, if early scoring norms were applied today, a quarter of the students would now be classified as gifted, and the number of certifiable genius should have increased 60-fold. "The result," he said skeptically, "should be a cultural renaissance too great to be overlooked." But of course, there has been an intellectual renaissance in recent decades, perhaps not in culture, but certainly in science and technology. Cosmology, particle physics, geology, genetics, molecular biology, evolutionary biology, and neuroscience have made vertiginous leaps in understanding. While technology has given us secular miracles such as replaceable body parts, routine genome scans, stunning photographs of outer planets and distant galaxies, and tiny gadgets that allow one to chat with billions of people, take photographs, pinpoint one's location on the globe, listen to vast music collections, read from vast libraries, and access the wonders of the World Wide Web. These miracles have come at such a rapid pace that they have left us blasé about the ideas that made them possible. But no historian who takes in the sweep of human history on the scale of centuries could miss the fact that we are now living in a period of extraordinary brain power. We tend to be blasé about moral progress as well, but historians who take the long view have also marveled at the moral advances of the past six decades. As we saw, the long peace has had the world's most distinguished military historians shaking their heads in disbelief. The rights revolutions, too, have given us ideals that educated people today take for granted, but that are virtually unprecedented in human history, such as that people of all races and creeds have equal rights, that women should be free from all forms of coercion, that children should never, ever be spanked, that students should be protected from bullying, and that there's nothing wrong with being gay. I don't find it at all implausible that these are gifts, in part, of a refined and widening application of reason. The other half of the sanity check is to ask whether our recent ancestors can really be considered morally retarded. The answer, I am prepared to argue, is yes. Though they were surely decent people with perfectly functioning brains, the collective moral sophistication of the culture in which they lived was as primitive by modern standards as their mineral spas and patent medicines are by the medical standards of today. Many of their beliefs can be considered not just monstrous, but in a very real sense, stupid. They would not stand up to intellectual scrutiny as being consistent with other values they claimed to hold, and they persisted only because the narrower intellectual spotlight of the day was not routinely shown on them. Lest you think this judgment a slander on our forebears, consider some of the convictions that were common in the decades before the effects of rising abstract intelligence began to accumulate. A century ago, dozens of great writers and artists extolled the beauty and nobility of war, and eagerly looked forward to World War I. One progressive president, Theodore Roosevelt, wrote that the decimation of Native Americans was necessary to prevent the continent from becoming a game preserve for squalid savages, and that in 9 out of 10 cases, the only good Indians are the dead Indians. Another, Woodrow Wilson, was a white supremacist who kept black students out of Princeton when he was president of the university, praised the Ku Klux Klan, cleansed the federal government of black employees, and said of ethnic immigrants, "Any man who carries a hyphen about with him carries a dagger that he is ready to plunge into the vitals of this republic whenever he gets ready." A third, Franklin Roosevelt, drove 100,000 American citizens into concentration camps because they were of the same race as the Japanese enemy. On the other side of the Atlantic, the young Winston Churchill wrote of taking part in a lot of jolly little wars against barbarous peoples in the British Empire. In one of those jolly little wars, he wrote, "We proceeded systematically, village by village, and we destroyed the houses, filled up the wells, blew down the towers, cut down the shady trees, burned the crops, and broke the reservoirs in punitive devastation." Churchill defended these atrocities on the grounds that the Aryan stock is bound to triumph, and he said he was strongly in favor of using poisoned gas against uncivilized tribes. He blamed the people of India for a famine caused by British mismanagement because they kept breeding like rabbits, adding, "I hate Indians. They are a beastly people with a beastly religion." Today we are stunned by the compartmentalized morality of these men, who in many ways were enlightened and humane when it came to their own race, yet they never took the mental leap that would have encouraged them to treat the people of other races with the same consideration. I still remember gentle lessons from my mother when my sister and I were children in the early 1960s, lessons that millions of children have received in the decades since. There are bad Negroes and there are good Negroes, just like there are bad white people and good white people. You can't tell whether a person is good or bad by looking at the color of his skin. Yes, the things those people do look funny to us, but the things we do look funny to them. Such lessons are not indoctrination, but guided reasoning, leading children to conclusions they can accept by their own lights. Surely this reasoning was within the ken of the neural hardware of the great statesman of a century ago. The difference is that today's children have been encouraged to take these cognitive leaps, and the resulting understanding has become second nature. Shorthand abstractions like freedom of speech, tolerance, human rights, civil rights, democracy, peaceful coexistence, and nonviolence, and their antitheses such as racism, genocide, totalitarianism, and war crimes, spread outward from their origins in abstract political discourse and became a part of everyone's mental toolkit. The advances can fairly be called a gain in intelligence, not completely different from the ones that drove scores in abstract reasoning upward. Moral stupidity was not confined to the policies of leaders. It was written into the law of the land. Within the lifetimes of many readers of this book, the races in much of the country were forcibly segregated. Women could not serve on juries in rape trials because they would be embarrassed by the testimony. Homosexuality was a felony crime, and men were allowed to rape their wives, confine them to the house, and sometimes kill them and their adulterous lovers. And if you think that today's congressional proceedings are dumb, consider this 1876 testimony from a lawyer representing the city of San Francisco in hearings on the rights of Chinese immigrants. In relation to the Chinese religion, it is not our religion. That is enough to say about it. Because if ours is right, theirs must necessarily be wrong. Question: what is our religion? Ours is a belief in the existence of a divine providence that holds in its hands the destinies of nations. The divine wisdom has said that he would divide the country and the world as the heritage of five great families, that to the blacks he would give Africa, to the whites he would give Europe, to the red man he would give America, and Asia he would give to the yellow races. He inspires us with the determination not only to have preserved our own inheritance, but to have stolen from the red man America. And it is settled now that the Saxon, American, or European groups of families, the white race, is to have the inheritance of Europe and of America, and that the yellow races of China are to be confined to what God Almighty originally gave them, and as they are not a favorite people, they are not to be permitted to steal from us what we robbed the American savage of. Nor was it just lawmakers who were intellectually challenged when it came to moral reasoning. I mentioned in Chapter 6 that in the decades surrounding the turn of the 20th century, many literary intellectuals, including Yeats, Shaw, Flaubert, Wells, Lawrence, Wolfe, Bell, and Eliot, expressed a contempt for the masses that bordered on the genocidal. Many others would come to support fascism, Nazism, and Stalinism. John Carey quotes from an essay by Eliot in which the poet comments on the spiritual superiority of the great artist. "It is better in a paradoxical way to do evil than to do nothing. At least we exist." Carey comments from a later era, "This appalling sentence leaves out of account, we notice, the effect of evil on its victims." The idea that the changes behind the Flynn effect have also expanded the moral circle passes a sanity check, but that does not mean it is true. To show that rising intelligence has led to less violence, at the very least, one needs to establish this intermediate link, that on average, and all else being equal, people with more sophisticated reasoning abilities, as assessed by IQ or other measures, are more cooperative, have larger moral circles, and are less sympathetic to violence. Better still, one would like to show that entire societies of better reasoning individuals adopt policies that are less conducive to violence. If smarter people and smarter societies are less likely to be violent, then perhaps the recent rise in intelligence can help explain the recent decline of violence. Before we examine the evidence for this hypothesis, let me clarify what it is not. The kind of reasoning relevant to moral progress is not general intelligence in the sense of raw brain power, but the cultivation of abstract reasoning, the aspect of intelligence that has been pulled upward by the Flynn effect. The two are highly correlated, so measures of IQ will, in general, track abstract reasoning. But it's the latter that is relevant to the escalator hypothesis. For the same reason, the specific differences in reasoning that I will focus on are not necessarily heritable, even though general intelligence is highly heritable, and I will stick with the assumption that all differences among groups are environmental in origin. It's also important to note that the escalator hypothesis is about the influence of rationality, the level of abstract reasoning in a society, and not about the influence of intellectuals. Intellectuals, in the words of the writer Eric Hoffer, cannot operate at room temperature. They are excited by daring opinions, clever theories, sweeping ideologies, and utopian visions of the kind that caused so much trouble during the 20th century. The kind of reason that expands moral sensibilities comes not from grand intellectual systems, but from the exercise of logic, clarity, objectivity, and proportionality. These habits of mind are distributed unevenly across the population at any time, but the Flynn effect lifts all the boats, and so we might expect to see a tide of mini and micro enlightenments across elites and ordinary citizens alike. Let me present seven links, varying in directness between reasoning ability and peaceable values. Intelligence and violent crime. The first link is the most direct. Smarter people commit fewer violent crimes, and they are the victims of fewer violent crimes, holding socioeconomic status and other variables constant. We have no way to pinpoint the causal arrow, whether smarter people realize that violence is wrong or pointless, whether they exercise more self-control, or whether they keep themselves out of situations in which violence takes place. But all else being equal, setting aside, for example, the oscillations in crime from the 1960s through the 1980s, as people get smarter, there should be less violence. Intelligence and cooperation. At the other end of the abstractness scale, we can consider the purest model of how abstract reasoning might undermine the temptations of violence, the prisoner's dilemma. In his popular Scientific American column, the computer scientist Douglas Hofstadter once agonized over the fact that the seemingly rational response in a one-shot prisoner's dilemma was to defect. You cannot trust the other player to cooperate because he has no grounds for trusting you, and cooperating while he defects will bring you the worst outcome. Hofstadter's agony came from the observation that if both sides looked down on their dilemma from a single Olympian vantage point, stepping out of their parochial stations, they should both deduce that the best outcome is for both to cooperate. If each has confidence that the other realizes that, and that the other realizes that he or she realizes it, ad infinitum, both should cooperate and reap the benefits. Hofstadter envisioned a super-rationality, in which both sides were certain of the other's rationality, and certain that the other was certain of theirs, and so on, though he wistfully acknowledged that it was not easy to see how to get people to be super-rational. Can higher intelligence at least nudge people in the direction of super-rationality? That is, are better reasoners likely to reflect on the fact that mutual cooperation leads to the best joint outcome, assuming that the other guy is reflecting on it as well, and profit from the resulting simultaneous leap of trust? No one has given people of different levels of intelligence a true one-shot prisoner's dilemma, but a recent study came close by using a sequential one-shot prisoner's dilemma, in which the second player acts only after seeing the first player's move. The economist Stephen Burks and his collaborators gave 1,000 trainee truck drivers a matrices IQ test and a prisoner's dilemma, using money for the offers and payoffs. The smarter truckers were more likely to cooperate on the first move, even after controlling for age, race, gender, schooling, and income. The investigators also looked at the response of the second player to the first player's move. This response has nothing to do with super-rationality, but it does reflect a willingness to cooperate in response to the other player's cooperation, in such a way that both players would benefit if the game were iterated. Smarter truckers, it turned out, were more likely to respond to cooperation with cooperation and to defection with defection. The economist Garrett Jones connected intelligence to the prisoner's dilemma by a different route. He scoured the literature for all the iterated prisoner's dilemma experiments that had been conducted in colleges and universities from 1959 to 2003. Across 36 experiments involving thousands of participants, he found that the higher a school's mean SAT score, which is strongly correlated with mean IQ, the more its students cooperated. Two very different studies, then, agreed that intelligence enhances mutual cooperation in the quintessential situation in which its benefits can be foreseen. A society that gets smarter, then, may be a society that becomes more cooperative. Intelligence and liberalism. Now we get to a finding that sounds more tendentious than it is. Smarter people are more liberal. The statement will make conservatives see red, not just because it seems to impugn their intelligence, but because they can legitimately complain that many social scientists, who are overwhelmingly liberal or leftist, use their research to take cheap shots at the right, studying conservatism as if it were a mental defect. Tetlock and Haight have both called attention to this politicization. So before turning to the evidence that links intelligence to liberalism, let me qualify the connection. For one thing, since intelligence is correlated with social class, any correlation with liberalism, if not statistically controlled, could simply reflect the political prejudices of the upper middle classes. But the key qualification is that the escalator of reason predicts only that intelligence should be correlated with classical liberalism, which values the autonomy and well-being of individuals over the constraints of tribe, authority, and tradition. Intelligence is expected to correlate with classical liberalism because classical liberalism is itself a consequence of the interchangeability of perspectives that is inherent to reason itself. Intelligence need not correlate with other ideologies that get lumped into contemporary left-of-center political coalitions such as populism, socialism, political correctness, identity politics, and the Green Movement. Indeed, classical liberalism is sometimes congenial to the libertarian and anti-political correctness factions in today's right-of-center coalitions. But on the whole, Haight's surveys show that it is the people who identify their politics with the word liberal who are more likely to emphasize fairness and autonomy, the cardinal virtues of classical liberalism, over community, authority, and purity. And as we saw in Chapter 7, the self-described liberals are ahead of the curve on issues of personal autonomy, and the positions they pioneered decades ago have been increasingly accepted by conservatives today. The psychologist Satoshi Kanazawa has analyzed two large American data sets and found that in both, intelligence correlates with the respondents' political liberalism, holding age, sex, race, education, earnings, and religion statistically constant. Among more than 20,000 young adults who had participated in the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, average IQ increased steadily from those who identified themselves as very conservative, 94.8, to those who identified themselves as very liberal, 106.4. The General Social Survey shows a similar correlation, while also containing a hint that intelligence tracks classical liberalism more closely than left liberalism. The smarter respondents in the survey were less likely to agree with the statement that the government has a responsibility to redistribute income from the rich to the poor, leftist but not classically liberal, while being more likely to agree that the government should help black Americans to compensate for the historical discrimination against them, a formulation of a liberal position which is specifically motivated by the value of fairness. A better case that intelligence causes rather than merely correlates with classical liberal attitudes comes from analyses by the psychologist Ian Deary and his colleagues on a data set that includes every child born in Britain in a particular week in 1970. The title of their paper says it all. bright children become enlightened adults. By enlightened, they mean the mindset of the Enlightenment, which they define, following the concise Oxford Dictionary, as a philosophy emphasizing reason and individualism rather than tradition. They found that children's IQ at the age of 10, including tests of abstract reasoning, predicted their endorsement of anti-racist, socially liberal, and pro-working women attitudes at the age of 30, holding constant their education, their social class, and their parents' social class. The socioeconomic controls, together with the 20-year lag between the measurement of intelligence and the measurement of attitudes, make a prima facie case that the causal arrow goes from intelligence to classical liberalism. A second analysis discovered that brighter 10-year-olds were more likely to vote when they grew up, and more likely to vote for the Liberal Democrats, a center-left libertarian coalition, or the Greens, and less likely to vote for nationalist and anti-immigrant parties. Again, there is a suggestion that intelligence leads to classical rather than left liberalism. When social class was controlled, the IQ-Green correlation vanished, but the IQ-Lib-Dem correlation survived. Intelligence and economic literacy. And now for a correlation that will annoy the left as much as the correlation with liberalism annoyed the right. The economist Brian Kaplan also looked at data from the General Social Survey and found that smarter people tend to think more like economists, even after statistically controlling for education, income, sex, political party, and political orientation. They are more sympathetic to immigration, free markets, and free trade, and less sympathetic to protectionism, make-work policies, and government intervention in business. Of course, none of these positions is directly related to violence, but if one zooms out to the full continuum on which these positions lie, one could argue that the direction that is aligned with intelligence is also the direction that has historically pointed peaceward. To think like an economist is to accept the theory of gentle commerce from classical liberalism, which touts the positive-sum payoffs of exchange and its knock-on benefit of expansive networks of cooperation. That sets it in opposition to populist, nationalist, and communist mindsets that see the world's wealth as zero-sum and infer that the enrichment of one group must come at the expense of another. The historical result of economic illiteracy has often been ethnic and class violence, as people conclude that the have-nots can improve their lot only by forcibly confiscating wealth from the haves and punishing them for their avarice. As we saw in Chapter 7, ethnic riots and genocides have declined since World War II, especially in the West, and a greater intuitive appreciation of economics may have played a part. Lately, there ain't been much work on account of the economy. At the level of international relations, trade has been superseding beggar-thy-neighbor protectionism over the past half-century, and together with democracy and an international community, has contributed to a Kantian peace. Education, intellectual proficiency, and democracy. Speaking of the Kantian peace, the democracy leg of the tripod may also be fortified by reasoning. One of the great puzzles of political science is why democracy takes root in some countries but not others. Why, for example, the former satellites and republics of the Soviet Union in Europe made the transition, but the stands in Central Asia did not. The wobbliness of the democracies imposed on Iraq and Afghanistan makes the problem all the more acute. Theorists have long speculated that a literate, knowledgeable populace is a prerequisite to a functioning democracy. Down the road from where I sit, the Boston Public Library displays on its entablature the stirring words, "The Commonwealth requires the education of the people as the safeguard of order and liberty." Presumably, by education, what the Carvers had in mind was not an ability to name the capitals of all the states one would pass through on a trip from Columbus, Ohio to the Gulf of Mexico, but literacy and numeracy, an understanding of the principles behind democratic government and civil society, an ability to evaluate leaders and their policies, an awareness of other peoples and their diverse cultures, and an expectation that one is part of a commonwealth of educated citizens who share these understandings. These competencies require a modicum of abstract reasoning, and they overlap with the abilities that have risen with the Flynn effect, presumably because the Flynn effect itself has been driven by education. But the Boston Public Library theory of democracy readiness has not, until recently, been tested. It's long been known that mature democracies have better educated and